Hey, good afternoon, everyone.
It is wonderful to have you back, those of you who are in the Virginia seminar and guests. If you don't mind, before I introduce our brilliant writer, student guest, memoirist, extraordinaire, rock critic, Carlene Bauer, I'd like to just have those of you who are dropping in for this writing seminar to introduce yourself, if you don't mind, and just maybe where you live and what you do and that kind of thing. So I'll start over here to my left.
Hi, I'm Ellie Flogg, and I'm a second year, writing second year at UVA, and I'm a foreign affairs major.
Excellent. I'm Will, and I go to William & Mary, I'm an English major, and I'm
I'm Kenneth Grant. I'm a rising fourth year. I'm an English major, and I was just walking by reading a book about writing.
I'm Peter Wilkinman. I'm a rising second year. I'm a religion classics double major.
Excellent. I'm Pete Hardwick. I serve as the lead pastor at City Church, and that's my son, so I pulled him in about 19 years ago.
My name is Ashley Elser. I'm in third year in the religious studies PhD department here.
Hey, Chris Norris. I'm in the director here.
I'm Karen Marsh. I'm the director of a local nonprofit called Theological Horizons.
And could we just real quick, someone? Could we just now the members tell the guests who we are?
I'm Susan Holman.
I'm Vanessa Oaks from the Department of Religious Studies.
I'm Jack East from Loyola University of Baltimore.
I'm Shay
Tuttle,
I work with the project.
I'm Valerie Cooper, leading the Residence of Duke Business.
I'm Peter Slade, newly counted bathroom in Canada. I work at National University.
Amy Laura
Hall, I teach at Duke University in Literature. Jim Guy,
I teach English
at
Indiana
University.
Jenny McBride, I teach at
Wartburg
College in Iowa.
And our esteemed guest who just walked in, tell us who you are.
I'm Kara Shum, I work with the Center for Christian
Study. Excellent. And I would like to introduce you before I introduce our brilliant writer, Bernier. A very dear friend of mine, and I am just so thrilled that you're, my colleague. So this is Mr. Ralph Eubanks, who is the new editor of the Virginia Quarterly Review. And we are delighted that you're bringing all these new editorial visions and energies into the VQR. And later on, at dinner tonight, Ralph will share a few words about the VQR and possibilities for us as contributors to the VQR. I would also just like to say that Ralph and I shared the singular privilege of being some of the first members of the first integrated class of public schools in Mississippi in 1970, following the Alexander versus Holmes County decision. And though we didn't know each other, we were just one or two counties over.
It's almost as if we did.
It's almost as if we did. And then we grew up and wrote memoirs about it. And we connected 10 or 12 years ago when we were supposed to do an event together at McNally in, where is that, Lower,
yeah,
in New York. And something happened and I didn't make it, but we have been cheerleaders of each other's work ever since. And now you're commuting from D.C. Perhaps eventually we can lure you to town, but thanks for getting here. So, and then probably this is something you may be interested in. Out-of-town guests, I wanted to plug real quickly, one of my favorite used bookstores in town. Charlottesville is a university town blessed with a number of very enticing secondhand bookshops. And my favorite on the corner is Hartwood Books, which is right down the hill. And then downtown, there are five or six, and there's one called Daedalus, which has a floor. I mean, it's not the Strand, but it's alphabetized, you know, with fiction and one for philosophy and religion and photography. And some of you who may want to go to dinner early could drop by Douglas. And as it turns out, I stopped by and bumped into a few of you at lunch. And this is the kind of find you have there. I just found the stories of Elizabeth Spencer, but the foreword by Eudora Welty. And this was $6.50. And tell me if you can find out in the state of Mississippi for $6.50. Elizabeth Spencer is a wonderful writer. I think she has not received the attention she deserves. Wrote a beautiful novella called Life in Piazza, and then one of the great novels of the civil rights era called Voices at the Back Door, and happened to be a student at a little Presbyterian women's college called Bellhaven, right across the street from Eudora Welty's house. And Eudora taught her one and only writing seminar at Bellhaven, Elizabeth's sophomore year, and she took the class and was smitten. And Miss Welty invited her into her home. And in many respects, this brings me to the introduction of my favorite young writer. not a Mississippian, a Jersey girl, but that's okay.
Yes.
who writes with the grace and the observation and the artfulness of Elizabeth Spencer, you know, Carlene Bauer. And I want to get on with Carlene, and I know you do too, presently. But I would like to say that it was also my singular privilege to have a 20-year-old Carlene Bauer in my political theology and social existence class in 1993 or 4 at Loyola College, now University. And then to have you, and you reminded me of this yesterday, do some work as a research assistant for God's Long Summer. And you may have been doing some of those sort of tracking down the family.
A little bit of that, yeah.
Cultural kind of,
I think, yeah.
Biblical guides to,
yes,
you know, dating and that kind of thing.
Yes, from the 1960s. Yes.
And then finished Loyola and did an MFA at Hopkins in nonfiction. And mm-hmm. you were working with
Mark Crispin Miller,
who's now, I guess, at NYU.
Right.
Very helpful. I always enjoyed his work. And then you moved to the big city to be a writer. And damn it, you did. That's what you did. Working for a number of years as an editorial assistant at Simon & Schuster. Working for almost 10 years at Elle magazine, where I used to, and I recall many, 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 many times picking up a copy of Elle while I was waiting to pay for a carton of milk, and, you know, looking, and there you were, moving up the...
very slowly.
Barely moved up to feature writer at some point, and we're doing some rock criticism there. As well as for Salon and One Plus.
M Plus One.
Carlene's first book was this fabulous memoir called Not That Kind of Girl, which is absolutely my, aside from all the memoirs here in the room, my favorite memoir of the past 5 years. Story of a New Jersey evangelical girl who goes on a very interesting journey in discovery, self-discovery, and is so funny and so smart, you know, I ask all of you to go and buy copies of this for birthday presents and Christmas presents and bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. as soon as you get home today. And then, you know, I knew Carlene was a hell of a writer. And then I read her newest novel called Francis and Bernard, which is an epistolary novel based on, or inspired by, I should say, the friendship between Flannery O'Connor and Robert Lowell. And I thought, God, she's not just a real great writer. She has moved into, you know, Marilynne Robinson territory here, and just produce something that has this sort of otherworldly quality to it. It's a gorgeous book, and it's been it's been a wide critical success. But as we know in the business, critical success doesn't always translate into
not really
financial
no.
success. You were featured in the New York Times no less than twice in 1 week. So when I thought about and in all of these works, faith and the complexities and intricacies of faith and experience are narrated in such artful and subtle and surprising and insightful ways. I couldn't think of a better person to come and be a workshop on faith and writing. So with all of that said and all of that rambling completed, thanks so much for coming down. Your first trip to Charlottesville, we hope it's not your last.
It won't be.
Okay.
It won't be. Thank you. Charles, thank you so much for that. Am I still audible? Okay. So first, what I want to do is, I may have to access that repeatedly while I give a talk, but.
And we may, just at one point, we may turn the AC off if it gets difficult to hear.
Sure,
and try to get cool air coming out this door.
So first, I want to thank again Charles for having me. And I want to thank you all for coming here. I hope I do not bore you. That is not my intent. But I'm very excited to talk to you, but also eventually when I stop talking with you. That's partly why I was so excited to come, because as you may imagine, living in New York, there are people who do believe or are sympathetic to belief, but you can't talk about it. I actually talk about it more than I thought I would with my friends, but I am really excited to get to exchange ideas about how to write about it or live it, even if you may not believe with you. So. First, what I'll do is I'm going to read a little bit from the novel, and then I'll get a little talk. And so, can you all hear me, mostly? Okay. So, the section I'm reading from is a section where the character Bernard has come back from being hospitalized. He's had an episode of manic depression. He's had a manic episode. And he's come back, and Francis, his friend, is writing to another friend about this. And then you'll see Francis and Bernard exchange some letters. And so Francis has gone to visit Bernard in Boston, which is where this letter transpires. July 12th, 1959. Dear Claire, do you know what heaven must be like? I mean, a child's conception of heaven, a place you dread being caught dead in because it must be everlastingly quiet and mirthless? It must be like proper Boston, which is where Bernard's parents reside. Every time I took a step in their house, I swear I heard the china and silverware rattle, no doubt an alarm to let the ancient proper Bostonians know that some Irish servant girl's descendant was trespassing on their grounds, possibly with the intent to burgle. And in the deep silence, a grandfather clock ticked off every eternal second. The house looked like the colonial era period rooms I remember staring into at the art museum, mahogany chests sitting like thrones in every room, discreet whispers of pewter and white lace. Bernard's parents were perfectly civil, but they seemed to have no actual life in them. His mother asked questions but didn't seem to care how you answered, and his father fell asleep at the table just before coffee was brought out. Bernard then woke his father up by whistling through his fingers, which is how he said his father used to wake him up when he was a teenager. "Do you want to give your father a heart attack right now, Bernard?" his mother said, floating toward the table with the coffee tray in a haze of matriarchal serenity. I just let Ted, another friend, and John, another friend, make the small talk. We spent much of that visit in their small backyard, which featured many handsome rose bushes. I couldn't help but notice they did not look as bug-eaten as the ones my father always tries to get going in milk cans outside our door. I could not say for sure, but I thought Bernard seemed rested and close to something like well. He said he was writing and had written 70 pages of something that didn't seem like a failure. He joked, he listened attentively, he pried some gossip out of John, no man hath greater love than this, that he lay down his scruples for his friend Lazarus. After a half an hour or so, he sent Ted and John away. Go talk to my father about the war, he told them, and they obliged. And then I panicked, wondering if he was going to become romantic. He took my hand, brought it to his mouth, and kissed it with no small amount of grief. I stopped panicking and felt grief too. He kissed my hand even harder and then eventually set it down on my knee without letting it go. It's terrible, he said. You answered a letter and befriended a monster. At this, his mother arrived in the yard. She clucked her tongue and both of us looked up, startled. I have never seen Bernard startled. He's usually the thing doing the startling. Stop that this instant, she said, and I noticed her chin trembling. You are no such thing. Neither of us said a word. Now, would you two like something to drink, she said. By this time, he had composed himself. I didn't think people's chins actually trembled, but hers did. No, thank you, mother, he said, and I could tell that he was pleased that she had intervened in some way on his behalf because of the note of gratified surprise in his voice. From what he's told me, that kind of protective, affectionate rap on the knuckles was rare. We were silent for a few moments, and then he began to stroke my hair, and I let him, even though I thought he might have been trying to push his luck. I didn't have the heart to crab about it. After a while, Ted came into the yard and gave me a look that told me I was doing the right thing. Time's up, Dante, he said to Bernard. I came back here because John was too nice to. Come on, reward us by rejoining the household. Later, there were another few minutes of panic. After lunch, when the men had gone out back to smoke their various tobacco items, I was left alone at the table with Mother Elliot, who said, as if 2 hours hadn't gone by between the yard and lunch, he's grown self-pitying. I'll have none of it. It's true that Bernard's penchant for exaggeration is trying, and it's true that I was glad she wrapped his knuckles so I didn't have to, but her lack of compassion gave me the crazy thought that I needed to get him home so my aunts could swaddle his convalescence in some good cheer. Before I knew what I was doing, I heard myself replying, there was ever anything to be self-pitying about, losing her mind might be it. She gave me a look that chilled my blood. At the time, I thought it chilled my blood because it did not differ much from the looks Bernard gave me that day in March, when he had a manic episode. There was a kind of glazed fire behind her eyes, and it wiped out any sense that she was speaking to another human being, let alone a human being who had a point worth considering. But now I'm not so sure I saw what I thought I did. I was glad to be in a car with Ted and John shortly after that, although Bernard did seem very happy to see us, and I was happy to see him that way. Love, Francis. This is from Bernard. July 12th, 1959. Dear Francis, so now you have seen the Elliot manse. What did it look like through your eyes? I felt so lucky to have the three of you here. Did you notice the way John gave up the gossip on Carl and Nancy? I actually think John rather enjoyed setting that story out, the way his smile grew deeper and ever more sly at each piece of information he divulged. It was as if he were proudly spreading caviar over a very long loaf of pumpernickel. I think I need to apologize for petting your hair as I did. I do, don't I? What is there to say? I miss you already. Now what? My mother is trying to get me to quit smoking by throwing out the packs of cigarettes she finds lying around the house. There are many because I lose them moving from bedroom to kitchen to yard, and I have to buy more to replace them, and so on and so forth. She didn't like you, I have to say. I find this amusing. Where did you meet that girl again? She said yesterday, and I could hear the rest of that thought hanging in the air. It surely wasn't Smith College. I think she can tell that you take pains not to know your place, and she wants to know who or what encouraged this wildness. I think she can also tell that I love you for it. I'm glad to be recovering in the summer. Isn't that silly? I've lived most of my life on an academic schedule, so I'm used to being set loose to loaf during these months. I can pretend that being set loose to recuperate is not that different. And there are many other people on furlough from their lives now. I can tell myself that I have not fallen too far out of step with the rhythms of reality. Now that I am off the drug, which was Thorazine, which was given to people in the 50s and 60s to treat manic depression, I can sit in the sun. I can come out in the garden every day to celebrate this fact. My mother has just opened a window to tell me to put some zinc on my nose. It is noon now, and I think I may be out here until the sky ripens into a peach bottom plum just because I can. I would have prayed to be delivered from that drug if I had had the ability to conceive of words that expressed preference or hope. I didn't care that I wasn't writing because I didn't care about anything. That was similar to what I'd felt during various depressions, words always out of reach. Words on a shelf too high for my lazy, faithless arms, words blurred and smeared around the sides of the errant crucible that was my mind, words a thing I had been smitten with now betraying me with their dullness. but this was worse. My mind was a ball of steel wool and lard. When they took me off the drug, I had a few panic attacks, it appears, waiting for my will to return. I did not think it would. But here I am at my parents' house, sitting in the sun, in their yard, writing you. I don't feel cured, but I do feel glad to go to bed without wishing for sleep to extinguish me. I did not think that was possible. I see that I may have my family in me after all. The other day, my father said that everyone's been concerned for my health, but no one likes a layabout. I would have never said a thing like that, but I am interested in, I am committed to, as he might say, moving along. It's not unlike the difference between nausea and health. When you're well, you can't imagine what it's like to be ill. You've forgotten the exact dimensions of the squirming lassitude. And when you're ill, you pant for wellness, whose sturdy contours now seem the unimaginable thing. The sane you, the real you, it must have been real. Why else the innumerable vivid scenes of leaving your house and ending up exactly where you intended, of speaking swiftly and unselfconsciously and being understood? You know it must have been real, but now you are not so sure. That dependable, uninterrupted flow of thought and action now seems a fiction, not your broken mind. But here I am in the yard. Here are birds. I'm writing, and I've written more than I thought I would. The neighbor's sweetly rotund daughter is making a halting mess of Schumann on the piano. And now a church bell comes in, tolling, "This is my father's world," and she gives up the Schumann to play along with hygienic Sunday school zeal. I went to tell her that that may be a wise choice, to take refuge from one of the most romantic of the romantics in the orderly march of hymns. I close my eyes, then open them, and the scene is fixed. It does not spin or buckle. I close my eyes, then open them, and the same. So I keep on writing. Francis, you too are fixed for me. You do not spin. You won't again, if I can help it. Neither one of us really wants to speak of what happened now that we are in the light, I can tell, and I think that's best. Here is one case, Francis dear, in which I am glad of your reticence. I've spent enough time lately trying to figure out how my parents and their parents and their parents, etc., created the conditions that led me to the hospital. In the beginning, I was glad of the chance to blame. When it comes to blaming one's parents, everyone loves the feel of a lighted torch in the hand, especially when it appears that that torch is being handed to you by a Harvard-laureled practitioner of one of the West's great interpretive frameworks. But that flame died quickly, and I felt crushed by the weight of my parents' blindness. I now feel sorry somewhat for my mother and father. I'm trying to feel sorry for them so that I don't feel sorry for myself. Don't feel sorry for me or afraid of me. Please remain my friend. Love, Bernard. I think I'll stop there because the sound of my own voice is putting me in a fugue state. So, but I have to talk more. So I'm just gonna reach over. Oh, thanks. Thank you. So first I'm going to give you a little bit of background on the two books I've written, and then there will be a free jazz portion of the evening in which I discourse on the matter of faith and writing. And by free jazz, I mean I have written a talk because you do not want to experience my extemporaneous talking. So please bear with me as I read. I will look up. But the free jazz is more that I've tried to string some concept together, and I think they hold. But if you catch me out, please let me know at the end of my talk. So when I was in college taking writing courses, we read a lot of what were called then, this was in the mid-90s, personal essays, Joan Didion being one of the main authors associated with that form. And I wonder, of course, at the wisdom of encouraging children to mine their personal lives for material and for credit, but that's essentially how my first book came to be, so I should stop thinking that way, or at least for the purposes of this talk. The first book was a memoir, as Charles mentioned. I don't know, some of you have read it, so. It told the story of my growing up evangelical, and then after converting to Catholicism, losing my religion altogether. If I was addicted to anything during college, it was the work of Joan Didion, who managed to insert herself as a character into her cultural reflections without becoming a distracting guide. But after I moved to New York in the late 90s, the memoir had started to take off as a genre, and I think this might have been in part, I mean, there are other reasons, but I'm thinking of books like Susanna Kaysen's Girl Interrupted, which was an account of her time in, I think, McLean Hospital in Boston, which is a very famous mental hospital, and also Mary Carr's The Liars Club. I have read Girl Interrupted, but I haven't read yet The Liars Club. So as the literary landscape was shifting this way, I found something that I was sort of itching to write, which was a first-person nonfiction account of reconciling what Cynthia Ozick has called world hunger with an evangelical upbringing that had warned me against the world. it seemed a little intellectually dishonest to me to cloak this narrative in fiction, because then it would just be another coming-of-age novel, and I felt that while in my 20s that would have been perfectly fine for me to write, I just felt like that maybe that I shouldn't be doing that. And it was actually the world as it was, its ironies, its comedy, that was what compelled me. The people, the very particular people in my life, compelled me, and I didn't want to create analogous substitutes that wouldn't ring true. But I was uncomfortable with the notion that I had to call what I was doing a memoir, since I was not Eleanor Roosevelt. Instead, I joked that I was writing a nonfiction coming-of-age novel. More importantly, I think, I wanted to see if I could write about the problem of trying to believe in the late 20th and very early 21st century, and I realize how grandiose and delusional that sounds as I repeat it out loud, but that was true. This is one of the main reasons for writing the book. I think that this is how I rationalize the book being nonfiction. I hope that readers would see it as a document, not just of one person's life, but a document, okay, possibly a critique, of a certain kind of Christianity that had been invented in America in the 70s. I wanted to articulate what it was like to believe and still want to be a thinking person, as well as what it was like to believe and yet still struggle mightily with doubt. The last time I'd read a book that had done both to my satisfaction, and I stress to my satisfaction, aware that these things are always subjective, it was back in college when I'd read The Moviegoer, which was published in 1961. That's a novel by Walker Percy. So I was hoping that my book might be one tiny way to help take the conversation back from the religious right, as well as the reporters who regularly covered Christianity, specifically evangelical Christianity, as if they were witnessing a Mayan sacrifice they were too bewildered and horrified by to sympathize with. I think we all have had experience reading these articles. Ideally, it would also be a potluck dinner in book form for anyone who'd ever sat in church thinking that they really wanted to love Jesus, but they just didn't love the groupthink he often came surrounded by. So then the second book, which I've read from, is an epistolary novel that followed the relationship of two writers as they fell in love. And this also was a response to not finding the kind of book I wanted to read in the world, which is to say a love story between adults that could not easily be dismissed as romantic comedy or escapism. It seemed like the last time that was possible was in the 19th century. And I realized that if you've read the Paul Ely essay, you also can detect that I would be sympathetic to his sort of ask, why are the last time that these kinds of books written years and years ago? But more on that later. So we all keep reading these kinds of books, these love stories that are last published in the 19th century, Pride and Prejudice, Jude the Obscure, Madame Bovary, Anna Karenina, but contemporary writers don't seem to want to write them. So I wondered, was it possible to write a love story that was centered on two mortals rather than vampires and make people care? Someone asked me if writing the second book was analogous to prayer, and I hadn't really thought about it that way, but I had to answer yes. I wrote it because there was no structure in which to contemplate the possibility of believing again or the ramifications of doubt. I couldn't go to church, I couldn't pray, and divinity school wasn't an option. I had no satisfying outlet other than occasional conversations with sympathetic friends and strangers for the thoughts and questions you have about God or faith when you declare yourself a non-believer, for the unfinished business, essentially. There were moments while typing and staring at the screen when I found myself speaking to God and telling him that writing what I was writing meant I must still love him, or at least the idea of him in some way, if I was spending my free time wrestling with him. My parents, if they heard this, would say, yes, that's exactly what that means. You still love him, and Augustine was right. Our hearts are restless until they rest in you. So my parents would also say, lay down your pride and stubbornness and open your heart to him. Maybe I will, eventually, one day. With that novel, this novel, I tried to put two voices in dialogue, one an irreverent yet submissive faith, that would be Francis, and the other a doubt filled with yearning, that would be Bernard, and these are voices inspired by Flannery O'Connor and Robert Lowell. I read deeper into their work after I lost my faith and was struck at how hilarious and cantankerous O'Connor was, which I hadn't quite realized when I had been assigned her stories and during college and high school. I was taken by the way that she somehow was able to allow Christianity and impeccable comic timing to coexist, because it seemed to me in my previous experience that Christianity and crankiness and comedy were mutually exclusive. And I can see why this would be for various reasons. But I was also moved by how idealistic, often disastrously so, Lowell was. I wish there had been more O'Connors around when I needed them. or that I had actually paid more attention to her. That's actually what I mean, that I had actually paid more attention to her. So I could see that just because the Gospels didn't have Jesus on the record as making jokes didn't mean we couldn't make them. I also sympathize with Lowell, who discarded many faiths and loves in a mad search for perfection he'd never find. So after a false start, the writing of the book took much less time than the memoir, which was shocking because I have been, for nearly all of my life, a very slow writer. I've always rolled my eyes when I've heard writers say things like, it just poured out of me, or once I started listening to the characters, they told me what to do. Whenever I hear these things, my mind conjures images of those famous photographs of spiritualists expectorating not ectoplasm, but essentially surgical gauze. So I, which is to say a lot of bull crap and whitewash. So these statements obscure the fact that writing is often really nothing more than consenting to give yourself an aneurysm for 3 to 6 or 10 hours a day. So here I was with the sentences, as the people say, pouring out of me, and because I was unable to explain this relative ease any other way, and the relative fearlessness with which I proceeded, I had no choice to wonder if perhaps the Holy Spirit was working. Wonder if there was a force bigger than me involved here. And I thought this was sort of ironic, because would it be finally now that I did not believe I would be meeting the Holy Spirit for the first time in my life? What was next? Speaking in tongues. I didn't mention that I'd wonder about the Holy Spirit to many people, because it's hard in these very rational times, and I guess you would imagine New York, to speak of feeling that a force that seemed to be coming from outside yourself, you know, to feel that moving through you. It's hard to talk about that without sounding, and I think in Shannon, where's Shannon? In your piece, you talk about a friend saying that when you avow that you have felt vibrations of an otherworldly or sacred sort, you often fear sounding like a stone hippie. Not you, but like that's what you fear. So I think, so this is why it can be difficult to talk both, I think, about romantic love and God without feeling embarrassed. We don't want to appear delusional, weak, undone, fanciful, childish, or naive. In our culture, it seems that to have faith in anything other than the reliable comforts of irony and cynicism is suspect. Speaking of embarrassment, when Charles and I were discussing what I might talk about today, one of the things, I hope you don't mind me mentioning this, one of the things that came up was the notion of how not to embarrass yourself while writing about God. And I thought, yes, let's go where the shame is. Let's ponder that. So I tried to, and I couldn't quite, I was blocked because I wanted to do a good job, so I was very blocked. So I asked my agent, who has worked with authors who have written narratives that are centered on faith, if he had any thoughts on the matter. And he said, well, I know this is simplistic, but make sure you write from the heart. And then he laughed because he said, how unhelpful can you get? That's basically like telling someone, just write a good book. But I think that may be one way not to embarrass yourself no matter what you're writing about, is to keep that in mind. Write a good book. So what does that mean, whether you're writing about religion or not? So a few things come to mind. One would be listening to the people you interviewed or are describing, and making sure that when we read your work, we hear them speaking, not you. Make your description as specific as possible, because being vague makes you part of the problem. Go on cliche watch. I know I'm probably using some here. I know these probably sound like freshman comp tools, but as writers, I think we can tend to make the process of writing very difficult for ourselves. It's like we think we have to reinvent the wheel or be seen lacking. So I do this to myself all the time, so I'm all in favor of simple rules which can act like a 2x4 to get you back to the task at hand. I'm thinking of an anecdote. A friend of mine was writing a memoir, and she was really having trouble organizing it, and her editor said, very zen-like, just begin at the beginning. And when she told me this, we both thought, yes, begin at the beginning, what a novel idea. But I feel like that, as writers, if anybody deals with writers, teaches them, like, it's always, like, even if you think you're uttering the simplest thing, like, it's probably what someone needs to hear to move on and finish the job. Anyway, that is a bit of a digression. But hopefully it'll lead back to what I'm going to talk about now. So people have said to me after reading my books, well, I wasn't into the religion stuff, but it was really well written. I liked the writing. So I have two responses to this. One is, well, if I didn't interest you in the discussion of faith, then I might have failed as a writer by not mesmerizing you with my prose. But on the other, I think, well, maybe that person glazes over religion the way others glaze over at physics, that would be myself, apologies, or baseball or some other topic. And maybe I should just be glad I didn't write about faith in a way that made them think I was proselytizing or gave them the effect of someone turning a prose fog machine on them, when really what all anybody hoped to do was try to grasp the ineffable. So in thinking about how to write about faith without embarrassing yourself, without turning on the prose fog machine, I guess, I kept coming back to Flannery O'Connor's Mystery and Manners, which is a collection of her essays. Has anyone read them? They are fantastic. And they're mainly talks that she gave on faith and fiction. She would go and speak to universities and do this. But I do think her directives are worth contemplating no matter what genre you're writing in. So in these talks, O'Connor emphasizes the importance of the concrete when trying to make your readers apprehend the divine. She says that in this regard, novice writers, quote, are conscious of problems, not people, of questions and issues, not of the texture of existence. They're conscious of case histories and of everything that has a sociological smack, instead of with all those concrete details of life that make the actual mystery, that make actual the mystery of our position on Earth. So when in hearing that phrase, the concrete details in life, I often jump to the title of Richard Wilbur's poem, Love Calls Us to the Things of This World. Is that a poem that? So that was how, I'll get to that in a minute, but that idea of love calling us to the things of this world was how I understood and understand Christianity, that it was love and it called us to the things of the world. It called us to pay attention to the pain and injustice around us and attempt to ameliorate it. It called us to pay attention to the beauty around us and be glad for it, because the earth was the Lord's and the fullness thereof. It called us not just to the unseen, but to the concrete, as O'Connor says. So in the poem, Wilbur writes, he's writing about laundry, essentially. And he sees, or the speaker sees laundry strung up on a line, night dresses, undershirts, sheets, tablecloths. And upon seeing this image, he's moved to say some of the following things. So the speaker exclaims at this sight, "Oh, let there be nothing on earth but laundry." And then goes on this way, "Let there be clean linen for the backs of thieves. Let lovers go fresh and sweet to be undone. And the heaviest of nuns walk in a pure floating of dark habits, keeping their difficult balance." There is laundry and there is love. So that's what I take from this poem. There is the sacred and the mundane. And to keep that duality in mind, we are both flesh and we are spirit. And not to flinch from that duality, I think, is the foundation of invigorating writing about faith. We are here on earth. God did not put us anywhere else. I think this is why The Moviegoer may still be the most perfect contemporary novel of faith, because Percy recognized that his character was shaped by a very specific place, New Orleans, and the character wasn't just after a reckoning with God, he was after a reckoning with his hometown. He was attempting to, as O'Connor says, penetrate the mystery of his exact position on earth vis-a-vis God and vis-a-vis New Orleans. In reading O'Connor's talks, I was struck also by these passages. She says, "The problem of the novelist who wishes to write about a man's encounter with this God is how he shall make the experience, which is both natural and supernatural, understandable, incredible to his reader. In any age, this would be a problem, but in our own, it is a well-nigh insurmountable one. Today's audience is one in which religious feeling has become, if not atrophied, at least vaporous and sentimental." And another quote of hers is, "When I write a novel in which the central action is a baptism, I am very well aware that for a majority of my readers, baptism is a meaningless rite. And so in my novel, I have to see that this baptism carries enough awe and mystery to jar the reader into some sort of recognition." And so she says that distortion in this case is an instrument. Exaggeration has a purpose. And it's not the kind of distortion, she says, that destroys. It's the kind that reveals or should reveal. O'Connor was writing before another great awakening created a more public, passionate Christianity than the quietly pious one she knew. And Paul Eli, I don't know if you read the essay, but he wrote an essay in the New York Times in December about how he felt that there was no fiction that had belief at its center, or a credible kind of belief at its center. And he offers up some possible reasons for this. And I think he rightly notes this drift in toward more public faith in the essay on the disappearance of believable belief in contemporary fiction. Faith is very public, he says, but it's not in our novels. He says that in serious literary fiction, his terms, Christianity is only shown to be, he says, either a dead language or a hangover. It's something to be repudiated after you've grown up or satirized. But I think he's wrong when he says that belief in this country is public but, as he says, marginal or of no consequence in a great many individual lives. It seems to me that the Christianity that Eli notes as being public, the one that has planted itself in the middle of national politics, is also the Christianity that has preached a highly personal relationship with Jesus to millions and millions of people. But Eli doesn't acknowledge this form of Christianity is possibly the reason for why there are no novels or memoirs with a credible belief being shown as an ongoing force in the characters or subjects or writer's life. It seems to me, and I may be very wrong about this, I would like to hear your thoughts, that evangelical Christianity is not a belief system that encourages belief in anything other than God or its rules about God. It is suspicious of art, of intellect, of anything that can cause a fissure in the bond between you and Jesus. As such, it's not a religion that can tolerate ambiguity, ambivalence, or a lot of questioning, all ingredients for writing that you might want to call serious. The other thing that I think is responsible for this lack, and that Eli doesn't address, is that writers still have a hangover from modernism and postmodernism. So a lot of serious literary writing is predicated on the notion that there is no one truth. The ultimate slipperiness of language, then, is what the author is supposed to be in love with, rather than God, or even character. Also, writers are often writing against orthodoxy, whether intentionally and inadvertently, and this can make it hard to render a life of belief believable. I want to be clear that I'm not romanticizing that tendency toward feeling not a part of things and being more willing to critique by standing apart, but just noticing it. So this emphasis, I'm almost done, this emphasis on a highly personal relationship with God and Jesus may have another effect on writing about faith. Because this kind of faith is extremely literal about the extent to which Jesus is involved in your daily life, this might have rendered O'Connor's call for distortion obsolete. In the incessant conscription into daily life, Jesus himself has been distorted. And no fiction, to my mind, can improve on the absurd and deeply depressing niche marketing that Jesus has been victim to. I think Amy knows a little bit about this. I will read journalism and criticism and history about this, but I don't want to read a novel about it. That's just me. I think even O'Connor, for all her cartooning skills, would have thrown up her hands at the difficulty at topping it. So we are living in a moment when religious feeling is sentimental, but it isn't exactly vaporous. It's vociferous. And now we are technologically able to pixelate ourselves into whatever form we like, so that what O'Connor might have called the whole personality is no more. Our language reflects this loss. We have only the energy for the most basic nouns and verbs. As writers, this means we have to fight harder to try to get the texture of existence right, especially since there is so much distortion happening in daily life thanks to technology. We distort ourselves, our news, our voices. On Facebook, we can edit out all life's unpleasantness. We are engaging in a mass scale in an erasure of what is difficult, ambivalent, contradictory, and subtle, which is to say we are striking out what it means to be human from the record. I think the human seems to be receding from our narratives. As humans, we seem to be receding from our own lives because of technology. I think we're sort of vaporizing ourselves away. A few years ago, a good friend of mine, Lauren Sandler, I'm about to talk about a possible antidote to that, published a book called Righteous, in which she reported on various segments of evangelical culture. She went to Mars Hill, she went to skate churches, and in her conclusion, she writes of how, being atheist and Jewish, she was envious of the community that faith gives rise to, the fellowship, friendship, love, and support. She wasn't interested in heaven, she said, but the human connection that she saw coaxed forth by the Gospels is what seemed transcendent to her. So I'm wondering then if what writing about faith could now offer both believer and non-believer is a reminder that we are not machines, that we are still unfortunately human beings, to remind us that we are trapped in bodies that have minds and hearts that often do, as Paul said, what we don't want them to, and that we are creatures who live in relation to one another, or maybe we're trapped in relation to one another. This kind of writing could remind us also that we are creatures who struggle in despair but are not averse to hope. It could serve as a record of the specificity of spaces, of faces seen, of voices heard. And maybe that in doing so, these books would be a powerful testimony to the fact that, as poet W.H. Auden said, we need to love one another or die. Mm. So those are my thoughts.